Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're coming to you live this morning from our friends at Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream, right on North Avenue here.
Yes, it's lovely.
The timing couldn't be more opportune because I'm in the market for a Mustang.
Oh, you are.
I was talking to Tracy about that, so we're seeing what we can do to work out the supply chain issues to get me my Mustang.
Yeah, because you've been renting a Mustang, right?
Yeah, I like it.
Well, I can hear you when I get to the station early. I can hear you coming because yeah. it's got a lot of
V8 engine. Yeah, that's that American ingenuity.
Yeah, uh-huh. But you like the grip on the road?
I do like the grip on the road. Yeah, so you've been reading your Road and Track again.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I came in on a wing and a prayer because my left brake calibrator went out again.
Well, why don't you see if Tracy has a car from this century that you could get into?
It is from 2007.
Yeah.
216,000 miles on that bad boy. But yeah, I came in with the hazards on, ready to tackle the day.
You should see if those kids that like to do the drifting downtown at Madison and Morgan may want to include your car in the parade.
Did you hear about?
You could just total the thing with your insurance company and get money for new car from Joe Cotton Ford. See how that works?
I would love to see. There was another drag racing circle of fire thing at 114th and Halsted, and kids from 14 different states came that were arrested. I mean, that's, you know, it's really popular. It's gaining attraction. It's a tourist attraction now.
Right. Well, word is out that you know, Chicagoland is sort of like Fury Road, and you get to do what you want. It's fun for the kids.
So come one, come all.
We'll talk about that a little bit later, but we begin today with the release of the heavily redacted affidavit that happened on Friday afternoon. As the Wall Street Journal opined, if you're going to indict a former president, you better have him dead to rights on something bigger than mishandling documents. And, of course, that's all we really got from what was not redacted, is that the focus was on the handling of classified documents. And it seems to me that based on what a number of individuals have said, we've talked about this too in terms of the Presidential Records Act and the powers that a president has to classify and declassify information, if it's true what Kash Patel and others have said, Kash Patel, former chief of staff for the Pentagon, at the Pentagon for the Secretary of Defense, that he was there when Trump declassified documents on his way out the door. If these documents that were in the president's possession had been declassified, then I don't really understand why he doesn't just say so, because that would largely end the discussion of any sort of prosecution, no matter how ridiculous it is, no matter how unprecedented it is, and it would be both ridiculous and unprecedented if it was just about documents. But that would end that discussion, and then it would demand the FBI sooner rather than later provide a little bit more transparency about what their real motivation is, because it's not about the president's handling of documents, no matter what they say, no matter what we're to glean from the redacted version of the affidavit. You know, all of what tells us, what gives us the real roadmap is, of course, been redacted at this point. But here was President Trump reacting after the affidavit in redacted form was released.
I did nothing wrong. And it's the exact same thing here. We were essentially attacked. We were broken into. They opened up safes. They brought safe crackers in. They brought many, many FBI agents in, all right before the midterms. And all when I have the best poll numbers I've ever had. This is a political attack on our country, and it's a disgrace. And the people understand it. The people understand it. And they could have come in, and they could have talked to us, and they could have taken whatever they needed. But instead, they raided it. They took my passports. They took things that they should have never taken with that are privileged. And it's a disgrace to our country. It really is. It's just, and it just never ends. It's the same people, the same leaks, the same, they leak to the same places, the same people doing the leaking. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. Our country's a wreck.
And it is the same people and the same MO. I think it's difficult to disagree with that. And even, again, people that are not on the same side of the political spectrum as Trump is or Trump supporters are, like Alan Dershowitz, are saying as much, including with respect to the overly broad language that was included in the affidavit as the portions that were unredacted.
Right. I mean, it was 38 pages, and it was so heavily redacted that what did you learn from reading it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So it seems to me there are two areas of inquiry here. One is the law, and two is the application of the law. And the application of the law necessarily includes discretion and necessarily includes a bit of politics because you're talking about political targets. I thought one of the better interviews I've seen on the topic over the weekend since the affidavit's release was from a former law clerk for Justice Neil Gorsuch. His name is Mike Davis. He was on Fox, and he provided some commentary on both the law and its application. So first, Mike Davis on the law.
This affidavit, heavily redacted affidavit, it further evidences that this home raid on President Trump was unprecedented, it was unnecessary, and it was unlawful. And again, what I've been saying since August 8th, the president has the absolute constitutional authority to declassify anything he wants for any reason he wants, and he doesn't have to get permission from any bureaucrat at the National Archives to do that. And that is confirmed by a 1988 Supreme Court case, Department of the Navy versus Egan. So there goes the underlying potential charge for espionage that's in this that was in this warrant. Second point, the president has the sole statutory authority to make the determination whether a record is a personal record that belongs to him or a presidential record that goes to the bureaucrats at the National Archives and then almost certainly gets sent back to the president to put in his former library, the former president's library. And that is confirmed by a 2012 decision by an Obama judge related to Judicial Watch and Tom Fenton's lawsuits against President Clinton related to 8 years of audio tapes in his sock drawer. So what is left? They're looking at obstruction. Well, it is legally impossible for a former president to obstruct investigations into non-crimes. The Justice Department did not have the power to even look at these crimes because it doesn't matter what the evidence shows in this affidavit, David, no matter what that evidence shows, as a matter of law, it is legally impossible for President Trump to have committed espionage or to have violated some Presidential Records Act. The Presidential Records Act actually contemplates that former presidents have classified records. It doesn't differentiate. Congress gives former presidents office space, secure office space. They give the former president's staff security clearance and Secret Service protection to guard these paper records.
So there's two important things in what Mike Davis had to say there. One is with respect to the law and the law that's being invoked as the basis to substantiate the raid. And that there was, again, if Trump declassified the documents, which is sort of the presumption in his commentary, he declassified the documents he intended to take, then there is no violation of the law there because it was within his power to do so. So it seems like we need a formal answer to that question. Then secondly, even if he did, there's no means to prosecute criminally a violation of the Presidential Records Act. This is something that's negotiated between the president and the bureaucracies. Something else he said, though, too, about the approach. They're trying to get him on obstruction of justice. Right. This could be part of the play. Obstruction, but you legally cannot obstruct justice when it's an investigation into a non-crime.
But the one line in the affidavit, that there's also probable cause to believe that evidence of obstruction will be found on the premises. And premises is in big, bold letters.
And that you cannot legally obstruct justice with respect to an investigation into a non-crime. So that's just telling you that their obstruction of justice is a flag that they raised. But unless you have an underlying crime you're investigating, there is no basis for an obstruction of justice charge, right, or investigation. And by the way, this is something they've done before. The same people, the same MO. This memo that was released regarding the Mueller investigation, the Office of Legal Counsel, in the memo sent March 24th of 2019, going your way back machine here, to then Attorney General Bill Barr, examined the legal case around whether Trump had interfered in Mueller's investigation by firing Comey or seeking to have Mueller removed from the probe. In the report, Mueller declined to weigh in on whether Trump obstructed the investigation, but did not absolve him either. You remember the memo said, the evidence in Mueller's report was, quote, not in our judgment sufficient to support a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that the president violated the obstruction of justice statutes. In addition, we believe that certain of the conduct examined by special counsel could not, as a matter of law, support an obstruction charge under the circumstances. Accordingly, there were no constitutional barrier, nor would we recommend under the principles of federal prosecution that you decline to commend such a prosecution. Barr, the day he received that memo, convened a news conference in which he said that charges against Trump would not be pursued. So giving you the timeline on this. The memo addressed Trump's firing of Comey and the earlier request of the FBI that he dropped the case against Michael Flynn. The memo, those events do not establish obstruction of justice, noting at the time that Trump was told by Comey he was not under investigation. But it goes on here. The memo, this is by a nonprofit crew. I'm blanking on what the acronym stands for. The memo sent to Barr presents a breathtakingly generous view of the law and facts for Donald Trump. Trump thanked crew for working to release the now infamous Mueller memo and yet another Trump prosecution. The New York Post reporting on this, particular line here I'm looking for again. The idea was that they knew that the Steele dossier was not substantiated, was a fake. They knew that there was no evidence of material evidence of any sort of collusion, but they pursued an obstruction case against Trump regardless. And this memo, these memos that have now been released regarding the Mueller investigation, substantiate that they knew there was nothing there and they pursued an obstruction of justice charge anyway. Or obstruction of justice investigation with the idea of charging the president for obstruction, but they couldn't make out that case. Here again, an investigation into a non-existent crime precludes the possibility of an obstruction of justice charge. So what you saw in the Russian collusion investigation is now, again, only knowing what half of what's in that redacted affidavit, but what you're seeing play out yet again. And all of this against the backdrop of we're here to save our democracy. We're trying to save our democracy. To the extent that this is the New York Post line I was looking for, but it's words to this effect. The editorial is, to the extent that democracy has been on the line over the last 4 years, it's the Department of Justice and the D.C. press corps that are on the opposite side of saving our democracy. The more they protest that they're doing it, the more they're seeking to undermine it with repeated investigations of a particular sort that are driven not by facts and not by the law, but just by Trump hatred and a media that whips people into a frenzy by gaslighting them about these matters. That's what we're seeing based on what we know and based on what you're hearing from people who quite well understand both the law and its application.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford and Carol Stream, kicking off our ticket sales for our annual Freedom Family Fest Fun Summit.
It's called the Palooza Freedom Summit. Thing.
Yeah.
And do you want to make the announcement now or should we wait till 6:35? Who's going to be at our Freedom Summit?
No, we'll tease it. Wait till 6:35.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm keep pretty impressed with the lineup, though.
Hold people in suspense.
Ooh.
I wanted to do some cleanup on the topic we were talking about, affidavit release yesterday, and just be specific about this repetition. We've been here before. It's like the Garcia-Vega commercial. Remember the Garcia-Vega commercial? He's doing it again.
He's doing it again.
Yeah,
yes,
this is sort of well. Garland is doing his Mueller impersonation. They are doing it again. Which is they have, at least to the extent of what we know right now, they have nothing on the merits, but they're persisting anyway with an obstruction of justice claim. I mean, the Espionage Act stuff is really a stretch, but looking at obstruction of justice. But again, you cannot have a obstruction of justice charge that results from an investigation into a non-crime. You need the predicate crime to be obstructing something. And this, it seems, is what's playing out again. And I say again because of this memo that was released in which the Mueller team essentially concedes they had come up empty-handed with respect to Russian collusion. But they still persisted.
Right.
And
because they can't admit that they're wrong and they can't admit that they made a mistake and they can't admit that this is a witch hunt.
Steele dossier was just speculative gossip based on the researcher, Christopher Steele, and his pals. The FBI knew it, but acted on the bogus information anyway, moved in part by the hysteria the media were creating on the basis of leaks from Democrat government insiders. We're seeing this play out again, too. And the line from the New York Post editorial I was searching for. Democracy was at stake, referencing the Mueller investigation. But the press and the relevant parts of justice were on the wrong side. No wonder no one except the willfully deceived trust them anymore. And that's where things are at as it pertains to Garland. Now, there are things that we don't know, but the early indications suggest that the skeptics that, number one, this was necessary, number two, that there were crimes committed, and number three, that the FBI and the DOJ are being less than genuine in what they detailed as their interest in these documents. It wasn't about being charged by some bureaucrat at the National Archives to preserve classified information. This is a fishing expedition related to 1/6. That supposition, here's another piece of supposition. The documents that the FBI and DOJ actually want that have nothing to do with whether the information, the classified information in his possession was declassified, whether it's being properly handled or not. Take a listen to what Mike Davis, this former clerk for Justice Neil Gorsuch, had to say, what his speculation is.
The librarians are asking for overdue copies of the overdue books that they're not overdue. The president has the legal right to declassify these records and keep a personal copy. And then they said that the attorney general didn't personally authorize this raid. He absolutely did. They also said that the Biden White House was not involved with this raid. They absolutely were, because White House deputy counsel to the president, Jonathan Suh, had to relay that President Biden waived President Trump's assertion of executive privilege, which paved the way for this raid. And so President Biden was absolutely involved in this raid. And so were his officials in the Biden White House counsel's office, Jonathan Suh. This is a political hit on a former president. And there's no allegation that any of these records got into the wrong hands, unlike Hillary Clinton's home server, where she had foreign governments hack the most highly classified secrets in our government, and she didn't get an FBI raid. So what was so urgent that caused the Biden Justice Department to go get these records? And I think it's because President Trump declassified and made personal a copy of his copy of the Crossfire Hurricane records, the Russian collusion records, and the Biden Justice Department never made them public because they're so damning on Obama, Hillary Clinton, the FBI, and the intel community.
Now, that's speculation, but it's interesting speculation coming from a sophisticated individual who was a good enough attorney to clerk for Supreme Court Justice. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's an alternative theory, or it could be something in addition to trying to get Trump that they're interested in. The particulars that have not been made public about Crossfire Hurricane and the concern that Trump might at some point make them public if he did indeed declassify them, casting the Mueller investigation, the FBI, and the Department of Justice in an even more negative light than they already have cast themselves.
And did you personally, Dan, learn anything from the warrant or from the affidavit that was heavily redacted?
Well, the things that we've discussed.
Right.
That's what you've learned. You start to get a sense of what they're. I mean, it's what they want you to know, and it's what they want you to believe. But here's the thing. Here's the thing about this intel business and classified information and managing intel. Well, it's a curious thing because Mike Turner, who's the ranking Republican on the House Intel Committee, sent a letter to the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. And Representative Turner was on with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend. And note the letter that he got back from DNI Grimes, the Director of National Intelligence, Ms. Grimes. Take a listen.
Maria, it certainly appears that. When you look at Director Haynes's letter, she says, we'll begin the process. We'll begin to look at these records. And she cites both the records that had been surrendered by President Trump voluntarily and those that were taken in the raid itself. So clearly, she's saying they've not looked at these. They'll go look at them. We'll do an assessment. Well, that means that the FBI is flying alone here. Supposedly, they're looking for classified documents, but they're not talking to anybody who deals with classified information. And that would seem to indicate that this is very, very suspect as to why it would rise to the level of needing to raid. They had other options. They should have taken them.
Yeah, they should have done a subpoena rather than, you know, a warrant and gone through his house. But they said that in January, Trump turned over 700 pages of government records, 184 classified documents with 67 labeled confidential, 92 marked secret, and 25 labeled top secret. But I don't even trust them. They could write down anything they want.
Avril Haines, Director of National Intelligence, essentially confirming, as Turner said, that FBI is not in communication with them.
Oh.
So this is classified information, but you're not checking with DNI. You're not enlisting other agencies that have relevant roles to play with respect to classified information or determining information that they want to keep classified or they don't want to be made public. Concerns they have about documents that could jeopardize national security. So as he said, the FBI is flying alone. Why would the FBI fly alone?
Because there's no there.
Or because they're trying to protect something that they don't want to be made public that has nothing to do with national security and perhaps everything to do with them.
Yes. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, and Turner also... Representative Turner, in that same interview with Bartiromo, also made this point about the special master, because at the occasion of the release of the affidavit on Friday afternoon, the Trump attorneys renewed their call for a special master to be appointed by the judge to review the documents and make determinations on which documents should be returned to President Trump, and they got a preliminary indication from the judge that he would indeed do that. Listen to Representative Turner.
At least the court saying they have an initial intent to award a special master authority to go over these documents and to return to former President Trump those items that should not have been taken from his home, and also demanding that there be a more inclusive accounting of what was taken. Because, as you know, when they released supposedly their inventory, for example, his passports weren't there. So there's a number number of items that we don't even know that they've taken. This went in court of the court saying their preliminary intent is to grant the special master really does show, once again, a court being very skeptical of what the FBI and the Department of Justice is doing.
And now, again, I renew the question, and this was a question I put to Trump's lawyers, if we could, I mean, not that they would necessarily answer it, but should be put to Trump and Trump's lawyers. If you did move to declassify all this information, that, according to, you know, legal scholars like Mike Davis and others, that's game, set, match. So why not indicate if you, and you've had senior level people in his administration like Kash Patel say that he declassified the documents he intended to take, which was within his authority to do so. So why not make that public and put additional onus on the FBI and the Department of Justice to explain themselves? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Ed.
Hello, Ed.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I couldn't hear you. I'm catching a train. But anyway, I'd like to know what it cost when the FBI subpoenas you or the Department of Justice. What does it cost an individual? I heard it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that people got to pay when they got to answer, even, you know, when they even got to talk to these guys, because you're not going to show up by yourself. Like, look what they did with Flynn. They actually ruined that particular guy. I honestly believe they're trying to scare anybody from going to help Trump for his next election bid. Plus, there's no penalty for the Department of Justice. There's no penalty for the FBI to do the things that they're doing, even though they're so outrageous. What's the penalty, Dan? There is no penalty for these guys. Anyway, have a nice.
Thanks for the call, Ed. David Lansing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Regarding just the timing, let's focus on the timing for a minute of this raid to answer the question. This is like a dumpster fire on one side of town while the bank robbers are robbing the bank on the other. There are four reasons for this. Number one, the one-year anniversary of the disaster leaving Afghanistan by Biden. Number two, to distract from Biden's dictator-like move to forgive loans, bypassing Congress. And then number three, emerging research showing that the vaccines could cause more damage than not having the vaccines. And then number four, the big recent one, was when Mark Zuckerberg is trying to walk back. It's ridiculous. Walk back the Hunter Biden laptop story like, yeah, we did that. Oh, we got to improve it in the future. Yet people are still using Facebook, the censor engine of the world, actually. You know, and this is all related to the fall elections coming up to make to put lipstick on the pigs of the Democrats. This timing of this raid, it's right in the middle of all this stuff. And I think it was calculated.
Thanks for the call, David. Appreciate it.
This is so political. I mean, come on. Shouldn't surprise anybody.
Corey Woodlawn.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy.
Morning.
Dan, I know you're an attorney, so I did want to ask you this. I heard that this classification system that we have isn't codified by law. I heard that it was only created through executive order. So is Trump off the hook? Basically, he's the executor.
Well, right. I mean, that's the issue, is what did he do on his way out the door within his powers to classify and declassify documents? Because as you heard from Mike Davis, the Gorsuch former law clerk, I mean, if he declassified the documents,
then there's nothing here.
That was well within his power to do right. So. He absolutely has the right under Supreme Court decisions to convert copies of classified information to, you know, personal collection, so long as he made the determination to declassify them. And then there's all these, you know, bureaucracies, National Archives and so forth that do the record keeping. And there's this back and forth between presidents and the bureaucracies if there's a dispute, which is, you know, one's been going on for the better part of the last year. So that's the thing that's confusing about all this, because it seems you have people saying he did. You have essentially people believing he didn't, thus the raid, and we don't exactly know what he did or didn't do.
But another thing that on an ancillary issue that people should be very upset is that President Biden lied again. This is him last week.
Mr. President, how much advance notice did you have of the FBI's plan to search Mar-a-Lago?
I didn't have any advance notice. None. Zero. Not one single bit. Thank you.
Right.
I mean, just another lie coming out of the Biden administration and out of his mouth.
So as you heard from Mike Davis, again, he provided a nice comprehensive review in 4 minutes or less. Garland essentially says, oh, the AG didn't know. Not only did he knew, he authorized it. Number two, Mr. 10%, the big guy didn't know. Well, he had to know in part because of what Davis said. The Office of Special Counsel in the executive branch had to give DOJ the all clear, their legal opinion, as to whether executive privilege applied to the documents that they sought. Was whether Trump's executive privilege that he asserted applied to the documents that he sought, and they got the opinion they did not, which greenlighted the raid. So don't tell me they didn't know. That is a lie.
And then Biden gets on a plane and with his son Hunter and, you know, go off on vacation.
And here again, why are you lying about things that you would otherwise are saying publicly are well within the bounds and national security and democracy's at stake, and yet at every turn you're lying or committing, you know, sins of omission with respect to the bases for the behavior. I mean, if you lie, that tends to impugn your credibility, and that's what we're getting. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I am certainly not a lawyer. I'm just wondering, if indeed all those documents were declassified, does that open them up for access to the media through the Freedom of Information Act?
It makes them more accessible. It's not thanks for the call, Larry. It's not 100%. There are other legal exceptions to FOIA, but it certainly makes them more accessible. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Good morning. I think this is really a second lesson for the American people that it's us out here against people in Washington and Washington bureaucrats. I mean, second time around, we better wake up. And I think this time they are so desperate to damage Trump in any way they can because he's had 4 years of experience and he knows where maybe some of the skeletons lie now. And if he does actually win, he will really clean house. They won't be able to get a Michael Flynn type person that's in his administration out so easily. Not that it was easy, but I think that he's going to, if he's before all fortunate enough for him to get in, I think he'll really clean house this time. And if he and I think a lot of Republicans on the Republican side, so-called Trump supporters, they're pretty silent. I think they're coward and quite frightened of the FBI. They see what they're doing to an ex-president, and they're worried about it for themselves.
Thanks, Marvin. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're coming to you live this morning from Joe Cotton Ford in scenic Carroll Stream, right there on North Avenue in Gary.
Where cars are not plentiful.
Well, they got the same problem as every car dealership.
Yeah, no, there are vehicles here that are for sale, but it's remember when there used to be vehicles on the showroom here?
We'll talk to our friend Tracy Kahn at the bottom of the hour, and we'll also announce the lineup for our Freedom Palooza Fest thing that happens in October or November or something.
It's called Freedom Summit, and it takes place Saturday, November 5th at the Westin Chicago Northwest
right before
in
the
Itasca.
Election. Yeah. Yes, but it's a pre-election rally, November 5th, 3 days before the election.
Trust me, you diehard AM 560ers are going to absolutely love the lineup, which we'll announce at 6:36.
Over the weekend, we had more rush videos, Paul Abdul style. It started at Canal and Cermak in Pilsen, and then the drifters moved over to Madison and Morgan. ABC7 had the story.
Hours after that, a chaotic confrontation caught on video at Canal and Cermak in the Pilsen neighborhood, where police tried to respond to reports of more drifting and drag racing, instead leaving six squad vehicles pummeled by heavy objects.
You really have to see the video. Radio doesn't do it justice because a police squad pulls up and then the barbarians run at the police with sticks, banging the cruisers and throwing, foreign objects, as it were, at the cars.
It's lawlessness, really. It's so sickening to watch.
It's a Mad Max movie every weekend in Chicago. It's good times. And then, as I said, they moved over to Madison and Morgan. And that awoke some of these slumbering West Loop Trixies.
Police say some people in that same group were involved in a street takeover at Madison and Morgan in the West Loop.
And when the cops tried to break it up, it moved over to where I live, which is close to Racine in Washington.
We're in the part of a town that's pretty sleepy at night, and so for the kind of commotion that happened at 2 a.m., we knew something was up.
Well, I hope that leadership will step in and actually hold people accountable.
Oh, isn't she sweet? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
They are precious at that age.
They're so sweet.
Where they,
newbies.
Where they believe,
they
believe in this concept called accountability in the city of Chicago.
Also, too, real quick, a five-year-old boy was shot in the head Saturday in the 7600 block of North Polina. Excuse me, Sunday night, last night, but in broad daylight at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Just another car drove up, shot him, and shot his 25-year-old relative who was driving the car, and he's in critical condition, but he's in kindergarten. My God.
His grandfather, Tervalon Sargent, spoke about the shooting of his five-year-old grandson. You've heard this plaintiff wail before.
All these kids want to do is go to school and play, and they can't even do that. And that's messed up. They can't even do that, and it just keep happening. It just keep happening. We got to do something.
Well, I hope that leadership will step in and actually hold people accountable. Mm-hmm.
So far this year, 238 minors have been shot in Chicago with 32 killed. Wrap your head around 238 kids, 18 and younger, have been shot.
We got to do something. And I'm not picking on that grieving grandfather. And I'm not even picking on the West Loop Trixie. Hopefully leadership will step in and provide some sort of accountability. You know, I wish this was more complicated than it actually is. I wish this, you know, required some deep thinking and a process of community engagement and a blue ribbon commission and all the stakeholders getting around the same table to hash it out. I wish it required all of that, because then there would be some sort of explanation about why this violence is so intractable. But it doesn't require that. It requires simple things like turning out the people in charge as soon as you have your next opportunity. And in Chicago, that would be in February at the state level, because the state is party to this lawlessness. Pritzker and Democrats at the state level obviously are party to this lawlessness, and they want to extend the culture of Chicago, the lawlessness culture, statewide with the Safety Act, as we talked about and will continue to talk about. So you have opportunities in November and in February. And you also have opportunities in terms of doing something. You also have opportunities at the local level on a daily basis to pressure these defund police, decarcerate inmates, non-prosecution acolytes, whether they're actual prosecutors like a Kim Fox or they're just their fellow travelers that have kept them in office to this point, to make the argument. To make the argument. Because otherwise you're going to get more of what you have heard for, well, at least the last 3 years under this political ruling class, this latest iteration of the Chicago Democrat Socialist Identitarian political ruling class. You're going to get the same thing. You're going to get those in charge suggesting they're being victimized by boogeymen that you can't see. By white conservatives in the suburbs and so forth. People like me.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, this is
spreading I'm spreading misinformation and you're the boogeyman.
So when you cannot defend your job performance and you don't want people to focus on what's happening on your watch, what do? You create a boogeyman to run against, which is what they do. So we have to do something, we have to do something, we have to do something. He who wants to change conditions must propagate a new mentality, not merely a new institution. That's Ludwig von Mises, but the admonition is what's applicable here. You need to start thinking differently about your city and your state. Not most of our listeners, but those within your social circles. We don't live in silos. It's not like you don't know people who maybe not Lightfoot or Kit Fox, but maybe are either ill-informed and don't know what to say and don't want to defend anybody, or they're even more ill-informed and they're defending the political ruling class that has visited these plagues upon the city and the state.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And it is sort of the funniest thing. It would seem to be the simplest thing to just think a little bit differently, to hold people in charge accountable by turning them out. It would seem to be the simplest thing, but it turns out to be the most difficult, as we've seen. This is Kim Fox, by the way, back in June.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Fox gave a sort of kind of a commencement address, if you will. This is Statesville. This was at North Park University. But it was for Stateville inmates. Stateville is a max security prison
in Joliet, right?
In Crest Hill now. But yeah, so these are hardened criminals. The North Park College has a school of restorative arts, and Kim Fox showed up on the occasion of a couple of a dozen inmates at Stateville who earned a master's degree in Christian ministry. Uh-huh. Okay. It's fine. I mean, yeah, I'm glad they're being productive, I suppose. But listen to what Fox had to say commencement of sorts.
I'm here today because, as I tell people, I have more in common with you than the lawyers that work for me. I have more in common with you because I've walked the path that you have walked, and there is no judgment of how we land where we land. It is God's grace.
What the heck is that?
So,
oh my goodness.
Because, this is sort of the same thing you heard from Lightfoot last week when she was going after my television ad. So because Kim Fox grew up in Cabrini Green, and despite the fact that she essentially followed the straight and narrow to get a law degree and to get involved in government and then to be elected.
Well, that's commendable.
Despite that, but because she grew up in Cabrini Green, she has more in common with convicted, you're in Stateville, violent felons than she does the lawyers in her office. Well, maybe that starts to explain why she takes the approach she takes to prosecuting violent criminals. That to me is an incredible. Just became known to me, at least. That's an incredible statement. But it's indicative of the mentality. I'm a victim. You're a victim. We're victims of what, you ask? Institutional racism.
She wants to clear the prisons.
You're the Cook County State's Attorney. How are you a victim of institutional racism? You're at the top of an institution. Generations and generations of institutional racism that we need to root out from the ground up. I have more in common with you convicted felons. And you know, if somebody's turning their life around, turning to Christ and trying to do something productive with the idea of getting out and being a productive citizen and speaking to other ex-offenders, you know, like John Ponder and other people we've had on the show who've done exactly the same, that's great. Okay, I'm all for that. I'm all for redemption. But that victimology that you just heard from Kim Fox, I have more in common with you who made choices. You didn't wind up where you were based on a lottery. She grew up in Cabrini Green. A lot of those inmates at Stateville probably grew up in tough circumstances too. But most of the people who grow up in tough circumstances don't end up behind bars for violent crimes, including Kim Fox. So, no, actually, you were responsible for the crimes you committed, and now what you want to do with the rest of your life is your choice. But how Kim Fox, who made most of the right choices, you know, in terms of being law-abiding, getting an education, and so forth, and she has more in common with violent criminals, that is really, that really tells you something about the mentality and just how poisonous it is. That statement informs the decision she makes as Cook County State's Attorney. Mm-hmm. So you want to figure, you can't explain what's happening, why she would do this, why she makes the choices she makes. She just told you why. And don't think Lightfoot's any different because she's not.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, over the weekend, I got together with three different friends of mine, all union guys. You know, the elevator guy was all about how, you know, things aren't that bad. And, you know, this new giveaway for the college tuition is good because her niece is going to benefit from it. The guy who teaches in community colleges, who makes part-time job, makes 50 grand a year, got a $45,000 bonus because his kids are so smart. And then the 134 guy who absolutely hates Trump and had a shooting right behind his house doesn't think that crime is all that bad. You know, there's just no talking to some people. I don't know how to get things across to these guys, but I'm getting to the point where, you know, if you're a liberal or a lefty and you buy into this crap and something bad happens as a result of it, I really don't care. You know, I mean, I don't want it to happen, but I'm becoming indifferent to these people because they're so freaking stupid that they don't understand, you know, that things are bad and they're going to get a lot worse the way things are going. And they just, you know, they're going to keep voting Democrat. Anyway.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, I mean, you can't save everybody. You know, if you have somebody that you run into a granite obelisk, then move on. I mean, there is this mentality. You saw it in this, still one of my favorite crime blotter stories of the last 6 months. Guy walking in the loop with his wife, and he gets winged in the hand by a stray bullet. He says, you know, that comes with city living. You know,
I was thinking about him yesterday, too, when I was on a bike ride. I thought, remember that guy? He's just like, yeah, that's just part of living in the city.
If you live in the city, don't be surprised if you take a bullet or two.
And criminals know that the Safety Act is coming. One guy who was out on bail for credit card and identity theft tried to sexually assault a woman and robbed her in her Loop hotel room. When he went before the judge and she denied him bond, he said, "That's some BS." He yelled that at the judge because he thought he'd get, you know, a cash bail or no cash bail or just get out without any slap on the wrist. And he was wrong. She sentenced him. He's bail denied for him. So it's, you know, the lack of respect from police and then judges, too, if they don't get what they want. It's crazy.
There was an op-ed in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that focused on the U.S. attorney there who's getting involved with the local authorities to combat violent crime because Minneapolis is becoming Murderapolis again like it was in the 90s, just as so many major cities are. And one of the things he said that is different about this time than the spike in violent crime in the 90s is exactly that. The idea among the repeat violent offender cohort of citizens, and it's a small cohort, but it's a particularly devastating one, as you see happening in all these major cities at largely the hands of a few, they just don't believe there are going to be consequences for their bad actions. You know, I can do a short stretch in prison and go back and be king of the street. That was literally what one offender in Minneapolis had said. And it's interesting there, too, because this also speaks to accountability at the authority level. So in Minneapolis, you have a U.S. attorney that is working with local authorities to supersize the charges to the federal level so that they do not receive turnstile justice at, say, the county level, go in at 26th and Cal and come out after a short stint, that you're seeing federal charges apply to violent crimes where appropriate. Why don't we have Lori Lightfoot and Kim Fox calling on, or not even necessarily calling on, just making the overture to work with John Lausch, our U.S. attorney for the Northern District, to do the same thing here? Why isn't that happening? Why? Because he has a different viewpoint on prosecuting violent offenders than those two do, and so they're not going to work together, and that's a leading indicator that separates even from Chicago, even from a liberal city like Minneapolis. That should tell you something about how far afield your Lightfoots and your Foxes and your Pritzkers are from even blue states and big blue cities like Minneapolis. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Yeah, well, I hope that Darren Bailey starts getting on the air and expiating on all this, because you know what? This is not a Republican form of government at all, what we have here in Cook County. I mean, you have criminals basically that are just going to be allowed on the streets with no cash bail. Absolutely ridiculous. What's going on in California with their regulatory board, declaring no cars? All cars have to be electrical vehicles by 2035. The ones that have to be new cars have to be sold in the state.
And now Massachusetts and Washington State have followed suit.
Well, and Virginia just had a law that they passed it under Northam that said they have to follow California. I mean, our courts are so pusillanimous. You know, John Roberts, he's a defender of the Republic. That's the guy we have. I mean, this is not a Republican form of government in so many locations. Our country is going to hell. Our civilization is going to hell. I don't know how it's going to end with people like this in charge. I really don't. And we better get better candidates, or the candidates better get off the schneid and start getting more aggressive, because the GOP nationally, they don't have any plan to deal with this. I'm afraid they don't even want to win Congress, and they wouldn't even know what to do with it if they did. They just sit there like they did in the past.
Thanks, Frank. Tony and Roselle.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Is it just me, or is everybody awaiting the emergence of a Bane-like character in this city?
Yeah.
One central goon that would lead the criminals. This is like Fort Apache, the Bronx. This is getting ridiculous. The news is jaw-dropping. And another thing you keep bringing up is the political.
One thing, Tony, you don't need a Bane here. You know why you don't need a Bane here? Because you have Fox and Lightfoot and Pritzker.
Yep. And you keep using the political ruling class, which ironically shares the initials with the People's Republic of China.
Shouldn't Kim Fox be in jail because she slapped her husband, by the way? Everybody forgot about
that. Well, I mean, she was never going to go to jail. She should have been arrested based on the law. But again, the law.
Where's the body cam footage we FOIA'd?
The law is enforced based on your politics. David in Wakanda.
Hey, good morning, guys. I know it used to say McCook, but I've lived in Wakanda for 4 years, just a stone's throw from your former colleague, Mr. Walsh. But my comment is, when I see all these savages every day on the news creating havoc in the city, I have zero sympathy for the people of Chicago, because they're going to run right out and re-elect most of these Democrats. I'm glad I live in Wakanda.
Thanks for the call, David. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're coming to you live this morning from Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream here on North Avenue. And we're going to be joined by our friend Tracy Kahn in just a moment. Feel free to stop in North Avenue and Gary.
Great.
We already had a fan stop in, Amy.
And he left a message for you and
left a little note because it was while we were broadcasting, which we appreciate. Hi, Dan and Amy. I feel like Casey Kasem.
Yeah.
Going to the mailbag. I'm Ron from Carroll Stream. Nice to see you. Called last week saying that Lightfoot and Pritzker don't get to talk about your pack unless they're willing to debate you. He's talking about me and my pack, my little controversy.
They just want you to know that you're loved, Dan.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate Ron from Carroll Stream stopping by. I encourage people to stop by, maybe pick up a Bronco or two when you do. We're broadcasting live from Joe Cotton Ford because we're launching ticket sales for our annual Freedom Palooza event, which is the Saturday before the November 8th election. So perfect timing. And who do we have this year?
Justin, can you get a drum roll, please? This is a big
deal. There it is.
Deal. Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, and Alex Berenson is going to be joining us also. We're going to have a former Trump campaign and podcaster Jenna Ellis will
campaign
be there.
Attorney.
Yes, sorry. And Catherine Engelbrecht from True the Vote, whose work was recently featured in the film 2000 Mules. And it's all happening on Saturday, November 5th at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. Additional names are going to be announced in the weeks to come, but if you're waiting to buy your tickets, you may miss out. The event will sell out, and so do not wait. Tickets will be available this Friday at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com. But if you're an AM 560 Advantage member, which I didn't know, we're in a frequent flyer program here. When you woke up this morning, you received a link to purchase your tickets today in your inbox. So if you're not an AM 560 Advantage member, go to 560theanswer.com/subscribe to sign up.
Yeah, there you go.
And our sponsors, should I go on? I mean, I can go on forever.
I think one of them is Joe Cotton Ford.
True, but Matrix Home Solutions, Automated Systems Incorporated, the Alpha Wealth Group, healthinsurancementors.com, Bishop Hill Winery, Monarch Technology, Oliver the Ornament, the Illinois Concealed Carry Association, the Illinois Family Institute, and Best Dental Group. Also Breakthrough Ideas, Total Clarity, Wealth Management. Tell me when you've had enough. Charles Equipment, Lil's Dietary Shop, and Line X of Roselle.
Yeah. Are you impressed with our marketing, Tracy Kahn?
I am. That's and terrific.
And you're on there, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's
Joe
awesome.
Cotton Ford, Tracy Kahn.
Tracy Kahn, proprietor, the Grand Poobah, the big cheese of Joe Cotton Ford. So tell us how it's going in the car biz with the supply chain issues that persist and chip issues. I don't know which is worse.
Neither do I. You hear about one, then you hear about the other. So who knows? We still don't have any inventory. As I told you this morning, we have 33 vehicles for sale on the lot, which we should have about 600 this time of year.
It's empty. We used to have cars in the show. I'm part of the team now.
Yeah, well, you are.
Lube the chassis. We used to have cars in the showroom, and the parking lot was packed, and there's 33 total. How many cars do you normally sell a month?
This time of year, we should be selling 150 to 180. We'll probably sell 68 to 70 this month.
Is it a demand issue or it's completely a supply issue?
No, certainly a supply issue. There's no problem with demand. There's plenty of demand right now, but just can't get the supply.
No, we were talking, and I'm being serious too. This is not some promo. I'm in the market. I want to buy a Mustang, and so of course I want to buy a Mustang from you.
You better.
And
don't cheat on the family.
And we were talking about that. So now this is a good season to buy a Mustang. You were telling me, but even if I ordered it today, I'm looking at
2 to 3 months at least, this time of year.
Yeah.
But if you ordered it in the spring.
And that's good news compared to some of the other vehicles.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. If you ordered a Bronco right now, you'd be looking at least a year.
Wow.
That's probably the longest of any of them. The other ones that take a long time are the electric vehicles right now. We just can't seem to get enough here, and it's because they're supplying the coasts with most of the electric vehicles.
And so is the chip issue the supply chain issue, or is it more complicated, other variables?
There are other variables. With the COVID shutdowns in China, that affected a lot of soft trim parts such as dash pads, door handles, armrests, those type of things. And so it's been, it seems like every time we turn around, it's something new.
Well, how are you surviving then?
The Mustang I'm going to buy is going to be $257,000.
Yes.
And then you'll have monthly payments on top of that.
Yeah.
We're surviving with service. We pride ourselves on having a very, very good service department. In fact, we were just nominated for the 9th year in a row, the best of the best service for a domestic dealer. From the Daily Herald. So,
and you kindly enough took my hobo ride back there.
Yes, we did.
My left rear caliber, I know, is out. I'm already diagnosing the problem.
Yeah.
So you can start there with taking off the left rear wheel.
You're putting your service department to the test by taking in that
It's great
junk.
When customers self-diagnose their problems.
Oh, I know,
and
exactly,
come in and tell
I know
us.
Exactly what it is.
Oh, yeah.
No, and if I'm wrong, come up later in the show, let us know. No, yeah. I know, because I'm telling
you,
I can self-diagnose.
I think I'll be on in a couple hours, so probably.
Okay. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But yes, absolutely. But I'd love to have you here to diagnose all of the other vehicles that come in, too.
I'll take it for a spin around the parking lot, and I'll let you know what's going on.
Do you even need to do that, or can you just sit there?
I'll just sit there
as
touch
it pulls
it.
In. You can just say, "Yeah, that car needs
the
this.
Automotive whisperer."
Exactly,
Amy Jacobson. Yes. Yeah. Well, good luck with that mid 19th century car that she's that she's riding around in. Service is making up for the lack of supply.
Yes.
What's the customer base, though, because I know you guys pride yourselves. We've talked about this before when you've had the show on. Somebody's bought 25 cars from you. I mean, mm-hmm. generation to generation in this area buy cars from Joe Cotton Ford.
And your father purchased a car from here.
Yeah,
thank
Bronco,
goodness.
He got a Bronco before there were no Broncos available.
That is true.
How do you sort of maintain the customer base that wants to get their next generation Ford from you but can't right now?
We take care of them with service, and that's the only thing that we can offer
extend
at this
the
point.
Use a little bit longer.
Certainly, yeah, and especially with our fleet customers. We closed our body shop in February of 2020, and we opened up a commercial service center. So now we're working on vehicles up to 52,000 pounds, which we were not able to do prior to this. Hmm. And it was the old adage, if you build it, they will come, and they did.
And tell me about, because not only you, but other dealerships are offering people, like they're calling customers and say, hey, we'll buy back your car and then give you X amount of money on top of that.
Yes, absolutely.
This
we do that all
thing.
The time. We talked about this earlier. Vans are just non-existent right now, and we're actually paying people back more than they paid for vans to trade them in and buy something new, or just not buy anything at all. Just sell us your vehicle.
And this is why used car prices are rivaling new car prices in a lot of classes of vehicles.
Yes, absolutely. That's the price of used cars, I've never seen it. I've only been here 41 years, so I'm still a little wet behind
new.
The ears.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen a used car that went for more than it went for new.
And that's and you're seeing that. I'm seeing that, too. You just peruse the Auto Trader or whatever, and you're seeing that. It's incredible.
Well, how many used cars do you have for sale right now?
28 right now, which is pretty good.
Yeah. Anything I
for
should
me.
Try out.
Yeah, you should think about getting something in the
but
last
minivans are
40
not,
years.
Are there any minivans for sale anywhere? I've been looking. And
very few, yeah.
Yes. I can make money off my hobo.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. You waited just long enough.
Yes, 216,000 miles.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Sell it off for parts. the skinny green new deal that was passed with the tax incentives and rebates for electric vehicles. So what's the distribution of gas powered to electric powered in your fleet, as it were?
Well, I know in 23 Ford's plan is to build 2 million electric vehicles, which would be as many electric vehicles as they are ICE vehicles, which is the internal combustion engine. So if that happens, I think we're going to have an electric problem, because I don't think our grid is set up to handle that many electric vehicles. I mean, you look at the rolling blackouts in California right now, and they're telling people only charge your electric vehicle from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. Well, that's not convenient for everybody.
Yeah, are you seeing considerably increased demand because of all the publicity surrounding electric vehicles, or do you still have, sort of your standard issue Ford devotee? If I want an F-150. I want the gas powered F-150. I want the gas powered Mustang. I don't want to go EV.
Yes, and the perfect example of that is Saturday we had a customer trade in a 2022 Tesla Model Y for a brand new F-150.
Really?
Yes.
So, are there any hybrids?
Yes.
I mean, can you have that 150 hybrid?
I'm driving one. It's right outside the door right there.
That's a hybrid?
That's an F-150 hybrid, yep.
Okay.
I get 26.7 miles to the gallon going to work and back. Driving through downtown St. Charles twice a day.
And if you buy it today, Amy, he'll throw in the rust proofing.
Well, I see
on that aluminum vehicle.
What can I do to get you in that car today? Let me go talk to my manager.
Yeah.
Wait a second. You can't do that. You're the guy. You've got nobody to talk to.
I don't.
So, but now you're
not
going to
run that game on us.
Hats, you're in the...
Well, that's for the Broncos. The Bronco is more of a cult than it is a vehicle. And so September 18th, you should come out. We're going to have a Bronco rally. We're going to leave from here, and we're going to stop three or four places on our way to Rocky Glen Park in Rockford, which is an off-road place where we can take our Broncos and go off-road and
I'll borrow
rock
Larry's.
Crawl.
I'll borrow your dad.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Larry, let me, and I'll give him my cat and take his Bronco.
Yeah.
This is working out so well.
Hold on.
This is
weird. I see a joke there.
Yeah. I'm not touching that. This is going to be like the Broncos like doing an annual pilgrimage to Sturgis. If you're a motorcycle guy, that's what's going on with the Broncos.
Absolutely, yes. And there are four places around the country where they do this thing called the Bronco Off Rodeo, where you get to take Ford's Broncos, not even your own. You get to take Ford's Broncos up into the mountains and rock crawl and go up steep grades and turn it without ever moving and. Kind of like a skid steer.
See, that's the nice thing about the Mustang. If I get the Mustang, I can just, I mean, to do the off-roading, to do the fun stuff.
Yeah.
I just go down to the West Loop, and I can do that any night.
Any weekend.
And then do the whole, you know, Rebel Without a Cause thing down there.
Well, I think you should order your Mustang today. Like, put money down and get it, if it's going to take 2 to 3 months, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Get it?
Yes.
What color do you want?
When I get my Bronco broken in, though, I'm going to go to the West Loop so I can see if I can make it through those potholes.
Yeah,
exactly.
And climb back out.
Yeah, exactly. That would be some off-roading.
Yes.
Just if you could get it in and out of those craters they call potholes in the city of Chicago. All right. He is Tracy Kahn. He is the proprietor of Joe Cotton Ford here in Carroll Stream, North Avenue in Gary. If you want to stop by, pick up a car. Amy and I are probably going to be removing two from the lot or from the those available to order here before the morning is out. And also, thank you, as always, for supporting Freedom Summit and having the courage to be public about your commitment to free minds and free markets and in our fair city and state. So we appreciate that.
Well, I love doing this, and I don't know how many years in a row, 6, 7 years in a row that we've done this, and you guys have been coming here to kick off the Freedom Summit. So it's always a great day.
And even during the pandemic, we went to free states. Remember when we went to Lake Geneva?
Yeah. Yes.
That was fun at the Abbey to keep it going. So again, if you want to buy tickets, they'll be available this Friday at freedomsummitchicago.com. The lineup includes Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many, many more. So, again, freedomsummitchicago.com.
Tracy Kahn, thanks so much. Dan and Amy coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford and Carroll Stream, Chicago's Morning News.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, with the release of the redacted affidavit related to the raid on President Trump's Mar-a-Lago compound. You've got varying legal interpretations of what one can interpret from what was made public and what was not made public, and that's about 50-50 with respect to the contents of the 38-page document. Alan Dershowitz, for example, said the affidavit contains sufficient basis for to find probable cause and to issue the warrant, saying that most judges would have issued the warrant based just on what was unredacted, what was disclosed on Friday. Although he at the same time he says the affidavit and the appendices seem exceptionally broad and virtually unlimited. So on the one hand, he says, yes, the judge was right and proper to issue the warrant. On the other hand, he is critical of the broadness of the document, and he says the overly broad and inconsistent nature of the affidavit is at odds with the Fourth Amendment's requirement of being particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So I'm a little confused by Professor Dershowitz. On the one hand, he was right to issue it. On the other hand, it's an unconstitutional violation of President Trump's Fourth Amendment right. So I don't know how you reconcile the two. So that's one question. And the other is the question of classified and declassified, mm-hmm. or classified or declassified, because you have representations being made by those in Trump world like Kash Patel that Trump declassified the documents he intended to take with him, which was in his power to do. And if so, then there's no basis for any investigation. This is Mike Davis, who was a law clerk for Justice Neil Gorsuch. Here was his description over the weekend on Fox of the applicable law and its application.
This affidavit, heavily redacted affidavit, it further evidences that this home raid on President Trump was unprecedented, it was unnecessary, and it was unlawful. And again, what I've been saying since August 8th, the president has the absolute constitutional authority to declassify anything he wants for any reason he wants, and he doesn't have to get permission from any bureaucrat at the National Archives to do that. And that is confirmed by a 1988 Supreme Court case, Department of the Navy versus Egan. So there goes the underlying potential charge for espionage that's in this that was in this warrant. Second point, the president has the sole statutory authority to make the determination whether a record is a personal record that belongs to him or a presidential record that goes to the bureaucrats at the National Archives and then almost certainly gets sent back to the president to put in his former library, or the former president's library. And that is confirmed by a 2012 decision by an Obama judge related to Judicial Watch and Tom Fenton's lawsuits against President Clinton related to 8 years of audio tapes in his sock drawer. So what is left? They're looking at obstruction. Well, it is legally impossible for a former president to obstruct investigations into non-crimes. The Justice Department did not have the power to even look at these crimes because it doesn't matter what the evidence shows in this affidavit, David, no matter what that evidence shows, as a matter of law, it is legally impossible for President Trump to have committed espionage or to have violated some Presidential Records Act. The Presidential Records Act actually contemplates that former presidents have classified records. It doesn't differentiate. Congress gives former presidents office space, secure office space. They give the former president's staff security clearance and Secret Service protection to guard these paper records.
So there's the recitation of the law, according to Mike Davis, and here's its application.
And there's no allegation that any of these records got into the wrong hands, unlike Hillary Clinton's home server, where she had foreign governments hack the most highly classified secrets in our government, and she didn't get an FBI raid. So what was so urgent that caused the Biden Justice Department to go get these records? And I think it's because President Trump declassified and made personal his copy of the Crossfire Hurricane records, the Russian collusion records, and the Biden Justice Department never made them public because they're so damning on Obama, Hillary Clinton, the FBI, and the intel community.
And now that last piece is speculation on behalf of Mike Davis, but on his part. But it is an interesting suggestion that maybe this was this was damage control by the FBI and DOJ. It's sort of a very public, confusing way to try and do damage control if they wanted a document in President Trump's hands out of his hands before he would make sensitive contents public, especially since he had a year and a half. To unpack all of this, the law and its application with us, pleased to be joined by Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So let's start with the affidavit and whether or not, based on what was unredacted, that it was right and proper for the judge to grant the search warrant to raid the compound?
Oh, I don't know if that's I think probable cause is a fairly low standard. I would say that based on what we knew from the public record, you could probably make probable cause out. So to the extent the affidavit parrots that, sure. But the thing is, you know, you point out the difference between the authority, you know, what triggers granting the warrant, which is like probable cause that a crime was committed and that evidence of the crime will be found there. And then there's a separate issue of what they're allowed to take. You know, the probable cause finding only gets you in the door. The warrant is supposed to be a particularized roadmap of where you're allowed to search and what you're allowed to take. Now, I think the disconnect here is that what gets them in the door is probable cause of mishandling classified documents. And I hear, everything that Mike is saying about the fact that the president has authority to declassify, but that doesn't mean he exercised it, right?
That seems to me the operative question, because you've got, as I mentioned, Kash Patel, former chief of staff for SecDef, and others suggesting he has this power and he declassified any information he intended to take. That's what Kash Patel has said. But Trump hasn't said that. And you would think that if he did that, he would say that and say, that's why there's no basis for any of this, is because I used the power I had. And so these concerns about Presidential Records Act and so on and so forth are not germane.
Yeah, well, I had a feeling you might ask me about this today, Dan. So I got out my handy dandy U.S. code. And in particular, the Presidential Records Act, which has a provision in it that I don't think has gotten enough attention, which is Section 2203A, which basically says that the president shall take all steps as may be necessary to assure that the activities, deliberations, decisions, and policies that reflect the performance of the president's duties are adequately documented, and that such records are preserved and maintained. So, I think the courts are going to find that, yes, President Trump had the authority to declassify anything he wanted to, but this idea that he could wave a magic wand over it, or that he could, like, imagine it into declassified status, I don't think is going to hold up in court. I think they're going to look at the Presidential Records Act and say, if he did it, let's see the documentary evidence that he did it, because he's supposed to document the activities and the directives of his presidency.
But now, that's very broad language, though, too. I mean, you would have to have, like, your 18 minutes of missing tape, something that's germane, that's not contemplated in some other document. It would have to be like a whole area, it seems to me, of presidential activity that was
I don't really think that's true. I think, major decisions and policies clearly have to be documented. And if he made a decision to declassify something, that would be something that would be, common sense says that ought to be documented.
Well,
what if it was Crossfire Hurricane? What if Davis is right?
Well, here's the second thing about that I'm going to repeat to you something that I complained about throughout the 4 years of Trump's presidency. I think you and I must have had this conversation 10 times. If there were those kind of documents, why didn't he declassify them?
Right.
We talked about this like a million times.
Right.
He had the authority. If he had these great smoking gun documents that would have blown Crossfire Hurricane out of the water, he was the one guy in the government who could tell all the other subordinates, I don't care what you think, I'm declassifying this. And he could have put it out. And he never did. So now, a year and a half afterwards, when he had 4 years to do this while he was president, and nobody could have done anything to stop him, now they're going to put it out? Now he's going to do it? Really?
So do you think that this is going to lead to an indictment?
No. No, I think, Amy, the only way that it makes sense to me that the Justice Department is fighting so hard not to disclose the stuff that's redacted
is that they don't think, they don't intend to prosecute this case. And the reason I say that is, in a normal criminal case, you would normally do the arrests and the searches at the end of an FBI investigation. They're frequently done on the same probable cause affidavit. You never want to have a situation where you're doing a warrant in the middle of an investigation where people can actually go to court and ask for disclosure of it. So this is highly unusual. And the only reason it makes – the only rational thing I can figure that argues for them trying to withhold all this information is that they're hoping that it never has to be disclosed. If it's a normal criminal case, you have to disclose the underlying affidavit because that's how the discovery rules work. That's how the defense lawyers get to make motions to suppress evidence. So why would they be fighting this like this if in a few weeks they're going to charge him anyway and all this stuff is going to become public? It doesn't make sense to me that they fight this hard for it if they really intended to charge him.
That is an astounding suggestion, though, because and I'm not saying you're wrong. I think you're right. I think they have documents that they want to preserve for whatever reasons, maybe very self-interested, maybe somewhat public interested. But you do what you did. You raid an ex-president's home and then you have no intention to prosecute him. You don't expect there to be any there. I mean, if it's boomeranging on the FBI and the Department of Justice now, wait until Trump doesn't get indicted and he can jawbone this issue for the next 18 months leading up to a presidential candidacy. I mean, oh my gosh, the decision to do it this way if you never really had him as a target.
Well, let me suggest two things, Dan. One is I don't want to suggest that I don't think they want to prosecute him on anything, because I'm fairly confident if they can make a January 6th case on him, they would charge him with that. But and by the way, you mentioned the open-ended warrant and how they got to pick up every scrap of records. You know, obviously, if any of that is relevant to January 6th, and we're talking about the stuff that Trump and his own people packed themselves, so presumably, if you were an investigator, you would figure if there's anything relevant to January 6th, this stuff is probably more likely to be relevant than the stuff they already had at the presidential archives. But if they find anything relevant to January 6th, they'll be able to use it.
So what
Second,
happens?
Let me,
oh, sorry.
I was just going to say the good faith reason for doing this, and I understand all of the other potential reasons. But the good faith reason for doing this, as we said many times during the Hillary stuff, is the intelligence community, not just the FBI, but the intelligence agencies, whenever there's a potential that highly classified information was mishandled or fell into the wrong hands or could have been seen by the wrong person, they have to do a damage assessment to figure out whether we have informants who are compromised, whether we have, you know, top secret intelligence gathering operations that have been compromised, because if that happens, the bad guys or the hostile countries could be feeding us disinformation.
Yeah, but
they
can't
do that competently without the document.
Yeah, but so then why is the FBI not conferring with DNI? Mike Turner, the ranking member of the House Intel Committee from Ohio, was on with Bartiromo yesterday saying he's got a letter from Avril Haines saying essentially that they haven't been in contact with the FBI because she's like looking forward to reviewing the documents and so on and so forth. Why wouldn't this be done in consultation with the FBI? Why would the FBI fly alone?
Because I think the Justice Department is in court now. Trying to defend the fact that it has a system to make sure that they go through potentially privileged information carefully. So if they said now, if they said publicly that they had given information to the intelligence community, then the court would ask, well, how did you know you were able to do that? How do you know that that's not, you know, no one's ruled that that stuff is not privileged information? And you said here in the warrant that we had this very deliberate, careful process where the filter team was going to go through all of it first before anybody else got to see it to make sure that we're not communicating privileged information. So I think they have to be deliberate about this because they're going to otherwise blow up the position they're trying to take in court.
What did you learn from reading the affidavit?
I really think, Amy, that I learned more from reading the National Archives letter that came out, you know, a couple of days before, because that had the interesting stuff in it. And I thought that, you know, what's in the affidavit that they made public was based on stuff that was already made public by virtue of government disclosures. You know, they're not going to make something public because the Washington Post reports it. But, you know, if there's a lot of information in a government document like that National Archivist letter, then they can put that in the warrant because it's already out there. So that letter gave us really what the chronology was up until May 10th, which was pretty illuminating. And then we have a lot of reporting from May 10th on. Like May 11th, they start to issue grand jury subpoenas. June 3rd, they have the meeting down at Mar-a-Lago. June 22nd, evidently, is when they subpoenaed the video camera, the security camera videos. So I think what we're narrowed down to, and I didn't expect to find anything out about this in the warrant or in the affidavit. I figured this would be the redacted stuff. But the question I think everybody wants to know is, obviously, something happened between the time they subpoenaed the video on June 22nd and the time they went in for the warrant on August 8th. And what we know about that period of time is they're looking at the surveillance video and the FBI is interviewing Trump staffers and Mar-a-Lago staffers. So in that like 5 or 6 week time frame, something obviously came up that convinced them that they had to go in, that there was additional stuff there that needed to be grabbed up, and that there was no way they could be confident they were going to get it voluntarily from former President Trump and his staff. But we don't know what that something was.
Or we don't know if there is a something, frankly.
Right. No, that's fair. Yep.
Yeah.
And who do you think the mole is?
I'm assuming something triggered it, but you're right. They could just have, you know, they could be fabricating it. I don't know.
And
Jared Kushner rejects the idea there was a mole. So we don't know if there's a mole or not.
I don't know.
That's reporting.
But I think the mole stuff is way overdone. The FBI was out interviewing people. They interviewed dozens of people. And you tell people, I'd like you to talk to me voluntarily, but I got this here nice grand jury subpoena. If you don't want to talk to me, you can come up to Washington and talk to the grand jury. You're going to get people to talk. Because they don't want to go, you know, they'd rather with their lawyer's presence talk to an FBI agent, or even without their lawyer present, talk to an FBI agent than have to make a trip to Washington to go to the grand jury. So you usually get people to talk that way.
If they don't have, you know, Trump putting on his honey-do list, plan insurrection on January 6th, then they're going to be in a lot of trouble, because you've got an exculpatory memo days before the January 6th that has him talking to SecDef and Milley about making sure their preparations for Jan 6th. You have what he actually said on that day, which, yes, you can interpret in various different ways, but it certainly was, now is the time for the coup d'etat. I mean, this is I don't know what they have or what they think they have, but it better be really, really compelling, or this is going to get ratcheted up on FBI and DOJ in ways they cannot anticipate, because apparently they didn't anticipate the fallout from the raid.
Yeah, well, of course not. And the fallout for the raid is a walk on the beach compared to if they charge him. I mean, that's going to be that'll be an earthquake. But I agree with you on the January 6th to this extent. You know, my personal opinion is, unless you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he was involved in a crime of violence, then you shouldn't be talking about charging him. Because to me, everything else they're talking about, like fraud on the government and obstruction of Congress, is really, you have to do two things that are impossible or should be. One is you have to figure out what Trump's state of mind is, and good luck with that, because I think he has convinced himself that there was fraud. And I think John Turley is right when he says, you remember that character from the, was it Vizzini from the Princess Bride? You know, the Justice Department can't go to the jury and say, it was inconceivable that he didn't know it was fraud. You know, I mean,
yeah. So Wally Shawn is not available, is, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, you have to criminalize a loopy legal theory. And, like, even if you think that John Eastman's legal theory here was the most frivolous thing you'd ever heard of in your life, we don't criminalize legal theories in this country. If we were doing it, when I was a prosecutor, I could have indicted five lawyers a day if frivolous legal theory.
And to paraphrase Shakespeare, that would have been a good start. But Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney, Manhattan, contributing editor, National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great week, guys.
You too.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream this morning, launching ticket sales for our Freedom Summit. You go to freedomsummit.com freedompalooza.net or something.
Well, it's actually freedomsummitchicago.com.
There you go, freedomsummitchicago.com.
And the event's going to be Saturday, November 5th at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. And the lineup includes Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, and Alex Berenson. Also, a podcaster and former Trump campaign attorney Jenna Ellis will be there, and Catherine Egelbright from True the Vote, whose work was recently featured in the film 2,000 Mules. And again, it's happening Saturday, November 5th at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. This event will sell out, so go to freedomsummitchicago.com.
Catherine Engelbrecht.
Engelbrecht.
Name assassinator. Yeah.
All right.
So how are countries doing that were California before California became California when it came to green energy policy? Well, one of them is Britain. And the news isn't great if you're one of the plebs in the UK. Household energy bills were expected to rise 40% this autumn. But on Friday, the government regulator announced they'll leap 80% in a single bound. That follows a 54% rise in April and brings the average household's annual bill in the UK to about $4,200, which is about 10% of the median household income in Britain. It gives you a sense of the growing proportion of your household budget that will be consumed by inefficient energy, basically, is what I would say. And remember, this is not just inefficient, it's also ineffectual. You're not getting the same level of power, are you? Thus the need, as we talked about the other week, in Spain to mandate that Spaniards not turn their air conditioning on such that it cools a room below 80 degrees. That's the sort of rationing that happens when you have green energy ideologues in charge who are not pragmatic about how quickly you can incorporate new forms of energy without manifestly reducing the quality of life for their constituents and a lot of other people the world over. And this has been a regular topic for Bjorn Lomborg, as he is perhaps the most prominent advocate for poor people around the world that struggle to get electricity, that struggle to have power to enjoy the creature comforts that we have in the West, and the policies in the West further eroding the possibility of the poorest among us around the world to enjoy the quality of life that we enjoy in the West. So it's not just inefficient, it's not just ineffectual, I would argue it's moral. Bjorn Lomborg is the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank. He's also the author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. It's great to be here.
So it's not just the poor and those in the developing world. It's also middle-income households in Britain and California that are going to start feeling like they're the poor in the developing world.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, on the poor, it's important to recognize it's not because they need creature comforts, right? It's because they need to get out of poverty. They need to stop dying from all kinds of very, very simply preventable both diseases and heat and cold deaths and everything else. But you're absolutely right. Increasingly, much of the middle class in the rich world is starting to realize, uh-oh, this is going to be very expensive. The fundamental problem here is that since the Paris Agreement in 2015, almost all politicians, bar Trump and a few others, have been pushing for stronger and stronger arguments against fossil fuels. Not surprisingly, the fossil fuel industry has responded by saying, all right, we're not going to invest in fossil fuels. So we've seen a drop of more than half of the investment in fossil fuels. Now, if we're still going to use almost the same amount of fossil fuels, which of course we were in 2021 and 2022, that simply means the price goes through the roof. Now, Ukraine is making this even worse, but let's not forget that the fundamental problem is we've decided, no, we can go all green way before we could. And that is what's causing a lot of this hurt. And as you talked about in the UK, half of the UK is now likely to become energy poor. This is a terrible situation. And of course, it's the kind of situation that'll unseat a lot of governments in Europe.
Yeah. So the Inflation Reduction Act doesn't do anything to reduce inflation. But how does it reduce anything with climate change, if it, anything at all?
So a lot of people are really excited about the Inflation Reduction Act because it supposedly does a lot for climate. But they actually also released, so what are the numbers? And I just plugged them in to the UN standard climate model that actually tells us how much the temperature is going to be, you know, by the end of the century. And you can just plug it in with and without the Inflation Reduction Act. It turns out that for our $369 billion that goes to climate in this bill, you end up with a temperature that is changed. That is a temperature rise that'll be less than 3/100 of a degree lower by the end of the century. You won't be able to measure it. And remember, this is the very, very optimistic and somewhat implausibly optimistic outcome. More likely, it'll be less than 1/1000 of 1 degree Fahrenheit. That's a terrible spend. You know, you're basically spending an enormous amount of money, and we won't be able to measure the impact even in 100 years.
Well, there's something else to this folly, too. I mean, there's so many layers to it. But one of the things is, if you look at government models that simulate energy consumption, what you find is, absent a carbon tax on fossil fuels, the incentive to consume green energy doesn't reduce consumption of fossil fuels. It just increases energy consumption overall. So the only way you actually decrease demand for fossil fuels is to do the one thing, and I'm not advocating, but I'm just talking economics here, the one thing that politicians won't do because it's too politically damaging, which is to impose a carbon tax, particularly when you've got gas prices at $5 and $6 a gallon here in America.
Yes. Yes, and so it's important, you know, if we do create more green energy, part of it will actually substitute for, because it's at the same price, it will substitute for fossil fuels. But you're right that what we're talking about is, you know, most green politicians have been advocating for a long time that fossil fuels should become incredibly expensive. They've now gotten their wish. And of course, all of them are sort of aghast at what that means for their voters. They're starting realizing, oh, wait, when you still run your economy on pretty much 4/5 fossil fuels, it's not a good idea to have fossil fuels be incredibly expensive. And this goes to show you're not going to solve global warming by making fossil fuels so expensive nobody wants them, because you're going to be unseated as a politician instead. The only way we're going to solve global warming is by making green energy so cheap everybody will want it. And that's through innovation. Remember, back in the 1950s, we didn't solve the air pollution problem in Los Angeles by telling everyone, I'm sorry, could you just walk? We solved it by telling people, or you know, innovating the catalytic converter. It costs a little bit of money, and then you basically can drive without polluting. That's how we should do it with green energy. If we could make, you know, say, fourth generation nuclear much cheaper than anything else, we don't need to have rich, well-meaning Americans or anyone else buy them and spend $400 billion in subsidizing. everyone will buy them, also the Chinese, the Indians, and the Africans.
But that takes time. And this is, you know, and again, we're on a political timeline rather than an energy timeline, a sensible timeline that's driven by innovation rather than politics. Mm. And so the interesting thing about this is all of the ink, all of the energy, if you will, that's been devoted to this. And Mark Mills writing in City Journal, over the last two decades, we've seen a 2 percentage point decline in hydrocarbons as the primary source of energy. 84% of all energy from hydrocarbons, that's declined 2 percentage points in 20 years as we've spent trillions on Solyndra and the latest gambits to incentivize rich people to buy Teslas and so on and so forth. It doesn't even move the needle because of the realities of, you know, an industrialized world, or at least for the industrialized world.
Exactly. I don't think anyone really has a sense of how slow things are going. So as you mentioned, we've moved a couple of percentage points. If you just extrapolate what we've achieved since 2015, when everybody joined hands in Paris and promised we were going to save the world, if you extrapolate that, depending on which energy statistic you use, we're going to reach 100% renewable somewhere between 2200 and 2400. We're just not anywhere near what people will talk to you about. Oh, we're going to do this in 30 years. No, we're not. And the only thing you're going to achieve over the next 30 years is exactly the kind of thing that you're seeing now. You'll try to make fossil fuels so expensive, and then everybody rebels and becomes really ugly, and people give up on climate policy. Instead, we should be focusing on energy innovation. It's not rocket science. You're only going to get the whole world on board if you focus not on expensive subsidies, but on cheap innovation. That's what solved everything else in the past, and that's what's going to solve this problem as well.
And what's your reaction to no more gas vehicles by 2035 in California, and now Massachusetts and Washington are following the same pattern?
Well, it's incredibly cheap to say we're going to outlaw fossil fuel cars by 2035, because obviously none of those politicians are actually going to be around when that comes. And then when the vast majority of people still want to buy gasoline cars, of course it's not going to happen. But it's more important to recognize the Biden administration's own data. So they publish every year, how many cars do we actually believe are going to be from the Energy Information Administration? And it turns out that they estimate that by 2050, not in 2035, by 2050, 13% of all cars, of all light-duty vehicles, so basically cars in the U.S., are going to be electric. 13%. So unless you're willing to subsidize out of pocket for pretty much all the remaining 87%, you're not going to get there anytime soon. And of course, the point is you can subsidize your way to this. Everybody likes to point out, you know, Norway. But remember, Norway is incredibly rich, parentheses, because they sell a lot of oil, and they feel comfortable about basically subsidizing electric cars to the point that it's almost free for people to buy them compared to gasoline cars. Now, of course, you could just distribute electric cars to everybody down at the shopping mall, and then everyone would have an electric car. But the point is, we can't afford that. And so if you're going to be realistic, instead of focusing on getting everybody on electric cars as long as most people want gasoline cars, we should, again, focus on innovation. Once electric cars are cheaper and better than gasoline cars, everyone will buy them. So the simple question is, why do you need to ban gasoline cars unless it's because electric cars aren't actually better?
You know, 2035, 2050, 2400, these are rounding errors to the government. This, Bjorn. Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream this morning, kicking off sales of our Freedom Summit, tickets for our Freedom Summit coming November 5th. FreedomSummitChicago.com is where you go to pick up those tickets. If you're a AM560 Advantage member, if you're not, you got to become a member, and then you get advance notice on picking up tickets to things like the Freedom Summit. Over the weekend, Mr. 10%, old big guy, was rallying the faithful in Maryland. And he had some, despite being a uniter, as advertised, he had some disparaging words for MAGA World. This is what he said at a fundraiser pre-rally. This comes to us from MSNBC, so you know it's accurate. I went right to the source.
The president said, quote, "What we're seeing now is the beginning or the death knell of an extreme MAGA philosophy. It's not just Trump. It's the entire philosophy that underpins the, I'm going to say something, it's like semi-fascism." That's a quote.
Semi-fascism. And if you think that's not the position of the Democrat Socialists, then you'd be wrong. DNC Chairman Jamie Harrison was on with Face the Nation over the weekend. Major Garrett was subbing. Not that it matters. They're interchangeable parts. But this is what he had to say about you and me, you know, the MAGA semi-fascists.
Mr. Chairman, you embrace the rhetoric semi-fascism to describe the Republican Party.
Well, it's not about the embracing. It's calling what it is, what it is.
What it is,
wow.
What it is. if you're a semi-fascist, then we call you a semi-fascist. Hey. And listen, he went on to explain why he uses that description, why the big guy, Mr. 10%, was right and proper to use the description as well. Take a listen to the nature of the argument, because it presents a real contrast that needs to be highlighted by Republicans.
In the end of the day, we are a country built on freedom. And when you chip away at that, when you see the bullying that takes place in places like Florida with DeSantis, when you see them chip away at privacy rights, when they try to demonize the other, the attacks on transgender kids and their families, the attacks on marriage equality that we're hearing from the Supreme Court, this is not who America is. We're about freedom and rights for all of America's people.
Not in the business of demonizing, says the guy who just doubled down on semi-fascist. But more to the point, it really underscores the divide between the two sides. What you hear from Jamie Harrison and the new Marxists is freedom through government. What you hear from Ron DeSantis and conservative reform Republicans is freedom from government. So it's either freedom through or it's freedom from. That, to me, is a pretty good binary for Republicans to present in the last 65 days before the midterms. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jonathan Williams. He's the chief economist and vice president for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
We're glad to be back with you, and as always, greetings from this land of make-believe here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, we appreciate your time. And so, you know, thinking about the accomplishments, because Jamie Harrison was ticking them off over the weekend of Face the Nation to a perfectly compliant Major Garrett, as you would expect, and the Inflation Reduction Act, the American Rescue Act, all of those freedom through government programs, the forgiveness of student loans, all of those freedom through government programs that the left touts. It seems to me, I don't know what you think, that this is a choice that should be presented in a straightforward fashion to the voting public.
No, I think you're right. I mean, this is, as Thomas Sowell would say, a conflict of visions, right? And this is exactly what we're seeing right now. I mean, if you like where we're at with the 8 or 9% inflation, you know, over $30 trillion of national debt, an economy in decline right now over the last two quarters, and then all this kind of one side, you have this Orwellian spin that wants to double down on really all of the failures of the last couple of years and add more to that debt and spending and taxing. And then I think, as you mentioned, Governor DeSantis and others out there, certainly the leaders out in the states that we follow with ALEC, are pushing the envelope towards you know, freedom-enhancing policies like flat taxes and lower overall regulatory and spending regimes. And, you know, I think the contrast couldn't be more stark right now. And even if you just juxtapose that on the 50 states, as we often track in and rich states, poor states, is, you know, just look at California, New York, and Illinois versus, let's say, Texas, Florida, and Tennessee. No income tax states, couldn't have different policy environments. And then just look at the outcomes of where the unemployment rate is, where the income growth is, where the job growth is for everybody across the income spectrum. So I think that that's exactly the right contrast as a free market conservative that everyone should be talking about right now.
Thank you for saying economy in decline and not recession, because, you know, recession is an ugly word. It's an accurate word. But it's an ugly word, so we don't like to use that, of course, out of respect for Mr. 10%. We saw on Friday the market get hammered when Jay Powell sort of rained on the parade of people who, I guess, were thinking that we've reached peak inflation. And basically he said, we haven't, and we're going to continue whacking your brokerage account until we get inflation under control. And so it seems to me that's going to put a damper on this attempt to manufacture optimism where it is not warranted by Democrats in the last 60 days before the midterms, because, of course, these pocketbook issues are at the top of people's minds.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's like, in a way, you want to just, you know, scream at the TV sometimes and say, what were you actually thinking was going to happen when you spend hundreds of billions of dollars more and tax hundreds of billions of dollars more and then have inflationary policies like the debt forgiveness plan of President Biden, among other policy mistakes? It's my co-author Art Laffer says this all the time. I mean, this isn't rocket surgery. When you spend more and you tax more, you're going to put pressure on more inflation and less economic growth. And so, you know, I think the predictable response from Chairman Powell the other day was exactly what we were afraid of, is when you add more inflationary pressure to the economy that's already at maxed out at 40-year high inflation, what did we really think we were going to get after what Washington, D.C. just foisted upon us a couple of weeks ago?
And who do you think is going to have to pay for this new student loan forgiveness that Biden rolled out? And is
right.
Even
I mean, all of us are going to pay for it. We're paying for it in actually a couple of different ways. We're paying for it now, and it's going to add to the inflation pressures, certainly, and put more pressure on the Federal Reserve to continue raising rates and hurting the housing markets and everyone's savings. And those pension funds that are already underfunded in all the states, like Illinois especially, those continue to have the pressure. And then, of course, we actually have to pay off the expense later on. And so we're paying for these new items twice, right now with inflation, and then, of course, down the road when the bills actually do come due.
And don't you, real quick, just to follow up on that, don't you think universities now are going to raise tuition costs because they can?
Well, that's such an important point. I was just talking about that over the weekend. I mean, this is exactly the kind of misaligned incentive. This is exactly opposite. I mean, the Wall Street Journal put it, I think, this way for Seinfeld fans out there. This is George Catanza-style government. Everything that we should be doing, they're doing the exact opposite. And, you know, what has been rising, you know, magnitudes higher already than inflation has been student costs and university costs, outside of people like Mitch Daniels at Purdue that have held tuition constant. The vast majority of these schools have already been raising a tuition far above inflation, and this is going to give them all the more incentive to do so. And by the way, give people all the more incentive to rack up more debt for degrees that may not matter in the future, because guess what? If we bailed out to student debt once, why wouldn't the federal government do it again when we have these progressives in power in Washington?
Right. Freedom is fascism or semi-fascism, and government dependency is freedom. That's sort of where we're at least that's the argument the left seems to be making. He is Jonathan Williams, Chief Economist and Vice President for the American Legislative Exchange Council. Alec, Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always great to join you. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Dan and Amy coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream.
We're going to take it down a notch, folks.
Yes. So why Dan Proft is single? This installment comes to us from Down Under.
Excuse me.
I mean, Australia.
Is this Country Thunder?
I mean, Australia.
Okay, thank you.
Australia nightclub said it will remove people who are caught staring at someone without that person's consent.
Oh, please.
Not kidding.
People watching is the best thing ever, especially at bars. You see what, you know, check out what people are wearing. And
you know, it's the old adage that what happens on a college campus does not stay on a college campus. So remember Oberlin College? This is like back when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
It comes after you were in college because you're many years my senior. Yeah. But it's Oberlin College when you had to, remember the story? You had to, at every stage of intimacy, you had to get consent.
That's right.
Right.
If you wanted to kiss, you had to have consent. If you wanted to do other things, yeah, it was a written contract, right, that you had to sign?
To deal with those butch feminists at Oberlin who were overly aggressive. But you had your attorney present with you in the car when you were on a date up at Inspiration Point. So that's sort of like this thing. This thing is I have to get permission from some, I mean, not me, but I'm just using me as an example.
Right.
Because I don't. I have to get permission to stare at somebody.
Well, what do you just look down at the floor when you're at a bar? No. I mean, what do they expect from you now?
I mean, there's the magical love at first sight, eye contact you get at the thump-thump clubs.
I don't think so.
But, first of all, and you can confirm this, I know how much women hate attention at clubs, which is why they wear nothing.
Right.
I know they don't want to be noticed.
Their hair and makeup. Yeah, don't look at me. I'm hideous. Yeah. Right.
But I mean, so maybe we should, I'm thinking we should do this, like, since we live in this dystopia, you do this Kurt Vonnegut style, Harrison Bergeron, where the attractive people have to be blindfolded.
Oh, okay.
So they can't connect. And then it's equitable. It gives the downtrodden, it gives the less attractive, the attractively challenged like myself, an opportunity to, I guess, side glance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and maybe,
right,
because if you have the, you don't get to see all the, and maybe you'll settle for.
Do they have stare police out? I mean, how are they going to enforce this?
Literally, it's going to be.
Hey, you looked at her for too long.
I guess, you know, if somebody complains, then, you know, whoever the ogler is will be thrown out. And, of course, it's always going to be the ugly guy because you want to be stared at by the good-looking guy. Now, again, I'm being chauvinistic because I'm assuming it's just the males ogling the females when in point of fact it could be a lot of ogling that goes from the fairer sex to the barbarian set.
Yeah. And this is another reason why Dan Proft
is it's because it's so complicated. I don't want to use dating sites because they're even more ghastly.
Do they have flyers up at the bar?
Do
they have flyers up saying don't stare at somebody for too long?
They made a statement. Now, I guess this is some sort of marketing ploy. That as a nightclub, we encourage you to interact with strangers. However, any engagement must begin with verbal consent. This also applies if you are, for example, staring at someone from afar. So how do you do that? You say, hey, hi, I'm Dan. I'm a creepy guy. I'd like to stare at you from afar. Fixate you and just track your movements. Would that meet your needs? All right, one other reason why Dan Proft is single.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer. Oh,
no,
there's another reason.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
To the flow here. I'm speaking into this, right? This is on. Groom in China is killed by lightning strike while posing for engagement photo shoot with fiance. You know, how many times does God have to tell you?
She's not.
Point taken.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, coming to you live from Joe Cotton Ford in Carroll Stream this morning as we're kicking off ticket sales for our annual Freedom Palooza Fest picnic.
Yes, it's not a picnic.
No, it's not a picnic.
It is taking place Saturday, November 5th at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. This year's lineup includes Larry Elder, Branham Tatum, and Alex Berenson.
Brandon Tatum? Is that who you're talking about? I don't know who Brando Tater. What did you say? What did you call
Marlon
him?
Brando. No, Brandon.
I mean, when you can't pronounce Brandon Tatum.
Brandon Tatum.
That's going beyond name
right.
assassination.
Also, former Trump campaign and podcaster Jenna Ellis will be there, and Catherine Engelbrecht.
Joby Tobias. What Joe? What is who's?
Stop it. From True the Vote will be there, and it's all happening again on Saturday, November 5th, at the Westin Chicago Northwest in Itasca. Tickets will be available this Friday at freedomsummitchicago.com. But also, if you're an AM560 Advantage member, when you woke up this morning, you received the link to purchase tickets today in your inbox. So if you're not an AM560 Advantage member, go to 560theanswer.com/subscribe to sign up, and then you can get your tickets now.
Speaking of renaming things, the L.A. Homeless Services Authority has, yes, the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, please perk your
what
ears
is
up.
That? Okay.
They've issued a call to stop using the term homeless. Because that's outdated and dehumanizing.
What are we supposed to call
it?
It
promotes othering, and you don't want to other others. You are to term them people without homes.
So that would make them homeless. Okay, well, people without, you know, you people without homes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
People sans homes, if you throw a Latin in there. Or you can use a phrase like, people who live outside.
Oh, okay. Outsiders.
You live inside and not outsider is othering.
Okay. Sorry.
It's not inclusive. Damn. You live outside.
Okay.
I live inside. They're equal habitats. They're both wonderful.
Oh, yes.
It's just
wonderful.
Different choices we've made.
Yes.
Or consequences we've suffered from the institutionally racist patriarchal society that
or
enslaves
that, yes.
some. At the to the benefit of others. Yes, yeah, so people who live outside. Regarding those people who live outside, there is a ballot measure that has been passed thanks to, incredibly, the Hotel Workers Union in L.A. So you may, if you're going to plan on doing a trip to L.A., you may want, and you're not staying at a friend's house, you have to stay at a hotel, you may want to venture out there before 2024 when this issue will be on the ballot for Angelinans to decide. Here's what's going on out west over by there.
In Los Angeles County, more than 60,000 people are homeless on the average night, and more than 20,000 hotel rooms lie empty on the average night. See where this might be going?
It's insane. It isn't going to solve the problem.
We think this is one part of the solution. By no means do we think this solves the homelessness crisis. But do hotels have a role to play? Of course they do.
So the union he leads, which reps hotel workers, gathered enough signatures and Angelinos will vote on a bill that would force every hotel in town to report vacancies at 2 p.m. every day, then welcome homeless people into those vacant rooms.
You heard there the proponent. That's a gentleman named Kurt Peterson, who's the union boss, or one of the union bosses for the hotel workers. And he went on to add this kicker. You hear from basically a hotel industry guy opposed to this, and then you hear from Kurt Peterson. You'll hear from them again. But listen to how he characterizes those of you less enlightened, more prone to othering, who would oppose this measure.
We don't want to head backwards into the segregated South, but that's kind of the language that they're talking about. There's a certain class of people, less than humans, animals they almost describe them as, to be honest with you. They don't seem to understand who the unhoused are. We're talking again about seniors, students, working people. That's who the voucher program would benefit the most.
Mm-hmm. So there you go, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you want to be a segregationist from the Jim Crow South, or do you want to be enlightened and allow homeless people to claim vacant hotel rooms, through city sponsorship, through city diktat with respect to these private property owners?
They floated that idea around in Chicago during COVID, remember?
I'm a
proponent.
When they
were going to house people?
I'm a proponent.
Really? Why?
Absolutely. 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 This is the city they chose. This is a business community that completely supports the power structure. Where have the hotel and lodging industry been all my life in Chicago? How is the policies of these COVIDian politicians like Triple Threat and Jelly Belly, how have they served your properties in Chicago. Not to mention, we have the scion of a hotelier family, one Jelly Belly.
Oh, that's right.
Hyatt Hotel.
He should be the one that should open the doors.
Absolutely. Live your values, honey bunch. Live your values. So let's do it. Let's do it. Let's not let L.A. lead the charge on this. Let's go. Homeless.
She was having a press conference today.
Homeless in the hotels. The ballot measure in L.A. We don't need to do things through plebiscite. We have leaders that we've elected to represent our interests. So let's do it. We've got a homeless problem in Chicago. All you have to do is drive around the city a bit and see it. Where has Triple Threat been with this sort of enlightened policy? Mandate the reporting and have the homeless fill the vacant hotel rooms. The hotel workers union in L.A. seems to like it. At least their boss does. I don't know how much the frontline workers are going to like it. But let's do it, right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Ralph Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I could see it now. You know, no job lock, no home lock. I would welcome the sight of stolen grocery carts scattered around lobbies with overflowing bags of mystery garbage, mini bars raided, and who knows, you know. I could just see it right now. I mean, living the Hyatt life. Put it on a commercial. Show all kinds of bums wandering around, getting free food, living free. Living on your dollar because prices will rise everywhere to accommodate that. But that's the little dirty secret that they don't talk about.
Yeah, why not? Why not? And, you know, yeah. And thanks for the call, Ralph.
The city would pay for it? I mean, who's going to put the bill? Or is it just out of the kindness of their heart?
No, the city pays, market rate for the rooms, like they're doing in New York City for the persons in this country illegally who've been bused there by Greg Abbott. So, I mean, maybe you set a rate a little bit below market value, whatever you want. I mean, the city can dictate terms to the Peninsula, to the Hyatt, to the Hilton, to all the big hotel operators, and to the little ones too.
Yeah,
the little entrepreneurs that have
the boutique hotels
are imposed upon as well. So why not?
But do you think guests that are paying full price are going to appreciate having, you know, but not all homeless? I mean, I don't know. I know I sound kind of racist if I say that.
Why are there no white homeless people?
No, that you're right. There are a lot of white homeless people. Yeah. The problem is homeless people are homeless because they don't want a home. They like the freedom of, why not, living on the lakefront with that view?
I don't know.
You get up, go in the,
According to the head of the hotel union there in L.A., homeless people are just workaday people, seniors on fixed incomes. They're not the mentally ill. They're not habitual drug users.
Are you kidding me?
Well, that's the way he described it.
Right. Well, I just was in San Diego recently. And I couldn't believe it. It went on for blocks. And it smelled. There was feces on the ground. It was unbelievable to me. And these two ladies were screaming at each other right next to my car. And she had a metal pipe. And she was about to hit her on the head with it. And chaos.
You're going to have disputes between neighbors. Happens in Lakeview. So what's the difference? So you had a dispute between the neighbors and the Garcettiville in L.A. or Santa Monica. Sure, what's the big deal? I don't understand.
But 60,000 people. They only have 20,000 rooms, and there's 60,000 people.
So they can double up.
Do a lottery.
They double up.
Double up. There you go.
Yeah, sure.
Or they could triple up.
Double up and bring out a futon.
There you go.
There's three to a room. What's the problem?
Take a shower, have a nice snooze.
I mean, look, are we going to live our values? Or are we going to be – I mean, why should I be able to stay at – a boutique hotel, and the homeless shouldn't, particularly when there's a room available.
Yeah, that's true. Jelly Belly,
are you saying I'm better than the homeless? I don't think so. So
we have to live our values.
There's no question about it.
Okay.
There's absolutely, we should do that. And I think, sort of like when Mayor Byrne courageously stayed at Cabrini Green for a night, maybe we could have all of the, the wonderful progressive leaders of the city of Chicago. They could stay
with them
at a Hyatt with the homeless for a night to show their solidarity with this cause. I think this is important public policy, and I really appreciate the L.A. Hotel Workers Union leading the way.
312-642-5600.
Joe in his car. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you're missing the big picture. By putting these homeless into a hotel, you give them an address, you can set up a voting booth in the lobby, you got more votes, keep them in power, and then it's another program that Lightfoot can use to soak the property taxpayers with. That's why I'm glad I sold my house and we're heading to a red state.
All right. Thanks for the call, Joe. Well, I mean, you don't need a hotel address. You don't need a home to be able to vote. You can register from a park bench.
Right.
But I agree with you, the convenience. It's not fair that I have a polling place in my building and a homeless person doesn't have a polling place at their park bench. So, yeah, no, I agree with the equity piece there. It's a good point. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I got nailed a while back. The staff at the hotel figured out that I was smoking a cigar in the room, and they charged me $150. I'm thinking the smell of a cigar might become mandatory in California. You might have to smoke one.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Mike Schomburg.
Yeah, hi. It's like the scene from Dr. Zhivago when he comes back from his exploits and finds his house inhabited by all of his comrades who have stripped the place clean and they all have their own separate
rooms. You're breaking up, Mike, but we got the Dr. Zhivago reference. Very good. Harry in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Oh, Harry.
Hi. Good morning, guys. And it's Chicago in here. I think that all the individual homeowners who have open bedrooms should report that by 2 p.m. as well.
It's a good
and
idea.
And be forced to take in, you know, the homeless there, you know, schizophrenics and drug addicts all combined, you know.
That's a great point. Thanks for the call, Harry. I didn't mean to cut you up, but that's a great point. When we're in the business of expropriating other people's private property, why would we stop at hotel operators?
Right.
Because, I mean, they're no more trained to deal with habitual drug use or mental illness or whatever has befallen somebody that's homeless than any private landowner. So, you know, you used to Airbnb.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
If you Airbnb and you've got a vacancy for any, you know, you report your vacancies in every day. And then if you've got a spare room,
right,
you report your vacancies. And
I don't mind cleaning the sheets again and every day.
Hey, you know, it takes a village. We're all in it together.
You got to step up, remember, shared values. There
I do
you go.
Remember. Oh, I remember.
Oh, I remember, too. Yeah.
John in Willowbrook, that is.
I tell you, I'd be rich. I'd take my Tesla, pick him up, drop him at the Drake at the Hilton all day long. I'd be a millionaire in no time.
There you go. Thanks. Right. Maybe the city will pay for transportation to and from the hotels that have room openings. I like that. Well, I think this is coming into focus. Paul in Pembroke Pines, Florida.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good.
I had an idea that you can split it into like work shifts at these hotels and house three times as many immigrants by doing 7 to 3, 3 to 11, and 11 to 7, and they take turns in the room.
All right. Very good. Thanks for the call. Run three shifts. Good. Gail, New Lenox.
Yes. Hi. Anywhere, if I travel 8 hours away from my home, I'm technically homeless. I have nowhere to stay, so I qualify.
Oh.
Very good. And expand the definition. I like that, too. Gail, very good.
Get a little, you know, a little getaway.
Greg in LaGrange.
Hi. It starts on a school playground as a kid with some bully taking your money, and now it starts with the government stealing your private property to give space to homeless. Anybody that knows about homeless shelters knows that it's a dog-eat-dog world in there, man. And it gets very, very, very uncomfortable because there's a lot of theft and there's a lot of violence. This is health. This is socialism coming to you, and it's only the beginning. Wake up, America.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.